when he passes away, it'll be the end of an era because he comes from an era when singers had to know repertoire from different countries in Latin America, because people would come up invariably on a
I'm
dance at a
sure.
dance.
Yeah.
He goes, "Mira, yo soy de Chile. ¿Tú conoces algo de mi país?" And you had to, come up with
You had
something.
to deliver.
Yeah. The most beautiful thing I ever saw him do was I saw him do a concert with that gentleman that I mentioned, Frank Valiente on piano, a Brazil, I mean, sorry, an Argentinian bandoneon player, which is their gigantic
Yeah.
accordion,
Right.
and Iram,
He
and a bass player.
can play the bandoneon?
No,
No.
there was a bandoneon
Oh.
player, but Iram was just singing, and the whole concert was just tangos. Tangos and milongas, and I'm
Qué
going,
lindo. And it was just bandoneon and what else?
piano and bass, and
And
Iram
him.
singing. And I was like, oh my God. It's like, what's sad is that the young singers of today, they don't have that kind of training
Yeah.
because that ambiente doesn't exist anymore. When I was coming up, you as a musician, you had to know how to play Brazilian samba, cumbia from Colombia, and not just cumbia, but all the different styles of music that happen in Colombia, like paseo, porro, vallenato, which is just several styles of music that are just prevalent in Colombia, and plena, bombas from Puerto Rico. Same thing. We're on a gig, somebody comes up, say, "Oye, ¿ustedes conocen algo de Puerto Rico?" I go, "Iram, ¿tú conoces algunas bombas o plena?" I go, "Claro, So, empieza con ritmo de bomba, si caen." So we start playing the rhythm, and he starts saying, he starts going off, "Alegría, bomba, chica, alegría." I forget it. We start doing a whole series of cortijo things, cortijo medley that I didn't even know he knew, but he knew it, But luckily, as I said before, with the time period that I came up, the musicians, whether it was a piano bass player or trumpet player, knew all that repertoire. So you had to know that to work as a professional musician.
Yeah.
That's just talking about the Latin scene. For example, in the jazz scene, jazz musicians have to know an extensive repertoire of songs, usually from the American songbook, because they provide great vehicles for improvisation. So when you get together with other jazz musicians in an impromptu setting, you say, "Hey, you know all the things you are?" The next question is, "Yeah, what key?" If you say no, then it's like, what is this guy doing on the gig? He doesn't know the repertoire. So it was like that in the Latin scene in the old days when I was coming up. It was more, I don't know. I don't know if the word continental is the right word, but it was more pan-Latino. Pan-Latino. That's,
Panamericano.
yeah, right. Exactly. Because tú siempre quieres complacer la gente que están ahí. Not everybody's Puerto Rican in the audience, and not everybody's Cuban, and not everybody is Dominican. So
That's right.
if some Mexicans are there and you could play Guadalajara like a huapango, the first thing they're gonna, "Oh yeah, man." And then what happens? They give you $100 bill as a tip. So there's an economic factor to it as well, knowing all that repertoire. There used to be a place on 40, what street is it? Is it 48th? No, not 48th. Yeah, 48th Street, between 9th and 10th Avenue, called the Spanish Music Center. It's right across the street from the, it's in the, it was used to be in the Belvedere Hotel. It was a guy named Gabriel Oyer, who was a Cuban guy. He was Spanish, but he grew up in Cuba. And he ran that place. And it was the only place in the United States where you could buy sheet music from Latin America.
Ah, qué bien.
So if you said, "Mira, Javier, necesito el himno nacional de Uruguay," I
Right.
go, "I got it right here," and you take it and you pay $1.50 for it.
Wow, those
You
days
know,
are
I mean,
gone.
those, he, yeah. He's a very important person in the history of Latin music in New York, because he had a record label called SMC, Spanish Music Center, and he recorded Chano Pozo when he first came from Cuba. and other people. So he was very important to the history of Latin music in New York City, as I said before. There's no place like that anymore. You used to go in, it was just racks and racks of sheet music. Whoa. And then he would clandestinely sell Tito Puente arrangements for like $100. Tito Puente would give him copies. He go, mira, vendelo pa 100 pesos. They split the money. You know, you know, things like that would happen. Yeah. Every time I go to the musicians union to pick up a check or something, I always look across that to the street and kind of like get teary-eyed because you walked into the lobby, made a right, and it was right there. It said, yeah. Spanish Music Center. He sold guitars too and things like that, but mostly it was sheet music. And he had these books, Boleros de Latino America, Volume 1, Boleros de Latino America, Volume 2. Every freaking bolero you could ever imagine was available in sheet music form.
Wow.
You know, so that was the kind of presence we had in this city. I'll give you another example of the things that existed in New York at the time when I was growing up. They used to do at the Waldorf Astoria, Brazilian Carnival, during the week of January through Three Kings Day. Because that's the time period they have carnival in Cuba. But they used to do Brazilian Carnival too.
Mm.
So they in one room would be, one ballroom would be Cuban Carnival, and the other one would be Brazilian Carnival. And I know because I did those gigs. It was amazing. And the people would come dressed up in carnival costumes and everything else. And they would go there and change.
Wild parties.
Yeah, yeah. And you had to know that music. You know, had to know that music and everything. You know, and the Brazilian carnival was heavy because they would hire like 30 musicians. So 15 would go on first. Most of them would be percussionists. The trombone is very prominent in Brazilian carnival. So you have like three trombone players or whatever. So you're hearing things like, Aqualera do Brasil or Felicidade or things like that. Then a musician would tap you on the shoulder to relieve you. And then you would take a break for like 20 minutes, and then you tap him on the shoulder. And so there was like, it was just constant. There would be no breaks, just like in Carnaval in Brazil. I remember those gigs were hard, especially if you were a percussionist.
Yeah.
You know, they were hard. I mean, but it was fun because everybody was united. It wasn't just Latinos there. It was, you know.
Everybody.
Yeah. That used to happen. They stopped doing it. I think it stopped after 9/11.
Hmm.
All that kind of stuff ended. After 9/11, you know. So, and with the advent of DJs too, DJ culture. But the driving force always in the city, musically, was always the Puerto Rican community. I mean, I'm Puerto Rican, but the Brazilians used to call me to play Brazilian gigs because they knew I knew how to play that music. And then maybe you see a couple of Puerto Rican horn players alongside some Jewish guys or whatever. But Puerto Ricans have always been involved in everything in this city musically, from jazz through any kind of other ethnic types of music.
And even mainstream.
Of course. I mean, you're talking about, look, I just give you an example. That song Fame, mm-hmm, by David Bowie,
mm-hmm,
the guitar player is Puerto Rican.
Yeah,
Carlos Alomán.
Exactamente.
Right. So
he's a star.
Yeah, yeah. So como el arroz blanco, estamos metidos en todo, you know. So we're always in everything, in the mix.
Mix of it.
And
it's true.
Besides being in the mix, we're usually the driving force as well. Can you imagine this city without Tito Puente?
Or Latin music without Tito Puente.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Mario Bazán, the musical director Machito, Afro-Cubans, I was his drummer for 10 years. He used to say the greatest musician in the history of Cuban music isn't even Cuban. He's Puerto Rican. And he's not even from the island. He's from New York. He's, you know, I remember he said that to a French journalist in Belgium. We weren't playing. And I was like surprised because Cubans are very proud of their culture. And he said it, you know.
Yeah, but credit where credit is due. Musicians, for the most part, are fair like that, no?
Yeah, yeah.
You guys like...
Mario was, like, very good like that. In fact, Tito was... In 1957, they had a big thing in Cuba celebrating the last 50 years of Cuban music, and they invited all Cuban musicians from all over the world to come back to the island, like Pérez Prado, Celia Cruz. The only Puerto Rican invited was Tito Puente.
What year was this?
57, the year I was born. Because Mario Bauzat told them, the organizers, listen, if you're going to do this, you got to have Tito Puente. They told him, yeah, he's not Cuban. So, pero coño, ¿quién ha hecho más para la música cubana que este señor? So there's pictures of that on the internet. You can see it. Him and Celia there and all these people like
Pérez Prado, I'm a fan.
Yeah, Pérez Prado, Fajardo, all those great Cuban musicians, Benny More, all these guys were there. And Tito was the only freaking Rican, you know? So... And it's funny, he told me, check out how interesting his life was. Jose Curbelo, who was Cuban pianist, virtuoso pianist, band leader, he gave Tito some of his first gigs when he was young. And he took him down to Miami when he was young. He had to ask his parents' permission. He was in high school. And when he took him to Miami, he said, come on, let's take the ferry to go to Cuba. So Tito told me he was in Cuba. Before he ever got to Puerto Rico and visited Puerto Rico, he visited Cuba first when he was a kid, you know, teenager.
Yeah.
But he was already gaying when he was 17, 16.
Sí, so porque él era
he was a wonder kid, So, I mean, there you go. I mean, he's just one example.
And what is it to you, I mean, to be a New Yorkian percussionist?
Well, I'm very fortunate because I'm 60 years old. I just turned 60 in June. So I grew up, thank you. I grew up in New York City. I saw the Bronx. I grew up in the South Bronx. I was born in St. Francis Hospital. No longer exists. You see the hospital in The Godfather. Then coming down the ramp, that's St. Francis Hospital. Yeah. It no longer exists. But then when I was born, my parents had an apartment, I believe, on Beck and then on Fox Street. And then finally, we moved to the Melrose Projects, which is like, you've seen that old show, Good Times, moving on up to the east side. That was like the dream of everybody to go into the... Because at that time, can you imagine, you know, you see these beautiful... large buildings going up, high rises and everything. And some of them had balconies. So we lived in the Melrose Projects. But at that time, the Bronx, the South Bronx, was a paradise. It was still very multiracial, Jews, Italians, Puerto Ricanos, African Americans, Irish, Germans. We used to go to a German meat market on Melrose Avenue to get meat. And I heard those languages coming up. But then the project that I lived in, grew up in, with my mother, my father, and my sister Joanne, we was predominantly African American. So I was very influenced by African American culture, as all Puerto Ricans were, because we were in contact with that community. So, but those African Americans loved salsa, they loved mambo, and everything else, and they went dancing to places like the Hunts Point Palace and the Grand Concourse. Plaza Hotel, et cetera, et cetera. So I also remember the Savoy Manor, which is right across.
On 100 in Walden, right?
Right, 149th, which used to, Hostos owns it. Now. Mm. They used to have big calypso dances there. Well, these big orchestras from Brooklyn. So a lot of the Trinidadians, Jamaicans, Barbadians, people from Tobago would all go there for that, and people from Harlem. So... it was a vibrant time period, but then, you know, with the Cross Bronx and with the building of the Bruckner, all those people got displaced and the city went bankrupt. Vietnam veterans come back in as junkies, so the mafia in the barrio, the Italian mob, flooded the South Bronx with heroin. and it all conspired to destroy the South Bronx. The banks redlined the South Bronx. The owners of the buildings who couldn't get loans to fix up the buildings or maintain them. Some of these buildings are over 100 years old, said, well, I can't maintain the building. I'll just burn it for the insurance money. I saw that gradually, little by little, happening. By the time I was 12 years old, 13, 14, it was insanity. But at the same time, I said in the beginning that I was very privileged, lucky, because all this music was happening at the time. We had incredible radio stations, WBLS, which was run by Frankie Crocker. He was the program director, and his nickname was I'm the Chief Rocker, Frankie Crocker, you know. He loved jazz, and he was hanging out a lot with Jerry Masucci, the mm-hmm. president of Fania. Mm-hmm. So Jerry, he would play Fania All-Stars. He'd play like Gladys Knight and the Pips, James Brown. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, you hear the Fania All-Stars. You know, he's playing Quítate tu pa ponerme. I mean, this is on a black station. You'd hear Latin Boogaloo on stations like WLIB, which is another black station. And then it's the time period that the Beatles came and transformed everything, not only in the United States, but all over Latin America. You talk to guys like us, all these great Nueva Trova singers, they all mention, from Roy Brown on, they all mention the Beatles. That changed everything completely. And I was part of all that. I mean, it wasn't a big thing for me to listen to Ramito or Trio Vega Bajeño, and then all of a sudden I'm listening to the Four Tops, the Temptations, and the Rolling Stones. And my father, like all Puerto Ricans, was very hip. The first record I remember listening to, the first that I can remember, besides the cartoon music, was Recuerdos de Navidad by Trio Vega Bajeño. And the reason I liked it, because es una guaracha puertorriqueña, and it's like you hear the bongos, you know, and then you hear the requinto going, and then el coro Navidad que vuelve tradición del año. Uno va alegre, uno va llorando. And then when the montuno would come in, Navidad que vuelve, Navidad que vuelve, un año que viene y otro que se va. I used to sing that. I used to play, it was on a 78. I used to play over and over. It drove my mother crazy. Quita eso ya, you know, like, but you know, se va a gastar el disco, you know, se va a rayar. And then the second record I remember hearing, which to show you the biculturalization of Ricans at that time, was Reach Out by the Four Tops, which the chorus goes, I'll be there to love and honor you. It's an R&B song.
Yeah.
From Motown. And then the third record I remember listening to, all these records my father bought them, was Dobie Gray's I'm In With the In Crowd. I'm in with the in crowd, baby. You know? But it's rock. It's rock R&B, you know? And then, my father bought all of Beatles 45s, you know, Day Tripper, She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, you know, all that stuff. And, I think one of the gifts I have is that I'm insightful, because when I heard Day Tripper by the Beatles,
I love that song.
When you hear this beginning, dun, 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 I said, coño, that sounds like a montuno.
Mm-hmm.
From like, you know, the music of Puente Machito. So, you know, it's basically, it's a guajeo, you know, like with the broken chords, the way we play them in Cuban music. But they just playing rock drums to it.
It's true. Yeah,
yeah.
Una salsita.
Yeah, yeah. So I
could even have some percussion, right?
Right. If you that's a song that if you put play the tumbao on the congas and some cascara with the timbal, it's right in there, you know. And then, you know, everybody's heard the Beatles do Bésame Mucho, which that they have. They recorded Bésame Mucho, yeah.
Because they recorded or was this?
Yeah, they recorded. The Beatles, you have to understand, the Beatles, they were gigging in Germany, and in different nightclubs in Germany, and European audiences are sophisticated. Sometimes you have people from Spain in the audience, where so they had to play songs not only of their own writing, but they also had to play songs of the American songbook, and anything that was a pop song of the day. And Bésame Mucho is a very popular song. So there's recordings of them singing those songs that they made famous, but in German. Huh. You know?
Well, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So they were a working band. They did weddings and all that kind of stuff. But then they got to the point where they could just play all their original music in a nightclub setting, and the rest is history. You know.
Yeah.
But the Beatles. I mean, but these the recordings, the records that I listened to when I was young were the records that my father would buy. So he's buying things like by Harry Belafonte.
Mm-hmm.
He's buying, you know, I remember he had the Live at Carnegie Hall albums. And I was fascinated because it's the first album I remember that opened up into two pieces because it was a double album.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was going, wow. And then I'm reading the liner notes and the whole thing.
They're so beautiful.
Yeah. And then he had music of Machito, Puente, Count Basie. And then, of course, and during that time period, there were all these great shows like Ed Sullivan. So what was great about that show is, you know, if you couldn't afford to see Duke Ellington in a nightclub, all of a sudden, tonight, Duke Ellington on the Ed Sullivan show, you know, you see him. Or any great artist. this is funny. I told Ray Barreto about this. I said, did you ever play with Javier Cugat? He goes, yeah, on the Ed Sullivan show. It was me, Ray Mantilla. I go, yeah, I saw you when I was a little kid.
Wow.
It was a little combo. Javier Cugat was with the little chihuahua holding it, and they just played in a little combo set. So he just called up certain musicians, you know, like a pickup band.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes, I tell him, do you remember anything? Oh, yeah, I remember. We went on a revolving stage, so the first band is on, first group is on, and then they're turning it around to. So Javier Cugat goes to Ray Mantilla, goes over to him, he goes, ríete, so canta mierda. You know, like, because Ray had like a stoic face. You know?
Para que saliera.
Yeah, it's a smile, you know, on camera.
Colgate. Okay.
Yeah, so.
So you remember that.
And I remember seeing Candido.
Wow. And then you meet them.
I know, yeah.
Future.
Yeah, check this out. That's the first time I saw Candido.
Oh, wow.
On the Ed Sullivan show with Lucecita Benitez.
Holy
from
moly.
From Puerto Rico. And that's the first time I ever saw anybody with an afro. Lucecita Benitez had this huge afro. And guess what? I found the footage on YouTube. Candido's playing bongo between his legs. And a conga on the side, and he does a solo. And Lucecita Benitez is dressed like in this tuxedo, this.
That was her style.
Like a unisex thing.
Yeah.
And I thought she was gorgeous, man. I'm a little kid. I'm very impressionable, and she had that big hair, that big afro.
Yeah.
And maquillaje and all. And but I see Candido for the first time. I didn't know who he was or anything. And all these years, and now we've been friends since 1980. We've recorded so many times, played and everything. And I've led a privileged life. So, but all that craziness was happening, what I told you about in the South Bronx, that the South Bronx is burning, the drugs. But this incredible music is happening. It's firing on all cylinders. From the pop music of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and the British Invasion, folk music is big at that time too. Pete Seeger and everybody else, the Four Freshmen. There's, you know, jazz. Mm-hmm. Is you can hear it in all the cartoons from Johnny Quest, Top Cat to the Flintstones. All these great variety shows, like not only Ed Sullivan, but the Johnny Carson Tonight Show, Dick Cavett. Yo me quedé. The biggest mistake my mother, well, the biggest. It wasn't a mistake. It was, for her, it was. She bought me a little television in my room. So she could see the telenovelas and all that while I could see. But I used to stay up late at night just to watch the Johnny Carson Tonight Show, because they had this jazz big band led by Doc Severinsen. And I was just floored by the drummer, Ed Shaughnessy, watching that. And then sometimes he would have Buddy Rich or Dizzy Gillespie on and all these great jazz musicians. And then I would flip over to the Dick Cavett Show because he'd be having that interesting conversation about the war in Vietnam, the Watergate hearings, and Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers.
I watch him a lot.
Yeah, so I used to flip. I'm 12, 13 years old watching this. And but I'm keeping the TV low so my mother doesn't hear me down the hall, because she'll come in and say, she'll turn off the... But that, all that happening at the same time formed my ethos. So I was very fortunate to grow up in that time period, because that was the greatest time period, not only for music, but for theater, art, everything. The poetry, The Last Poets with Felipe, Gil Scott-Heron, Victor Hernandez Cruz. I read that book, Snaps, that he wrote. I was, again, fortunate. I took an exam to go to the School for Gifted Kids. So I'm reading Victor Hernandez Cruz in the sixth grade. So I was very sociopolitically conscious simply because the Vietnam War was happening at the time. And you had to be, because by the time I got to high school, everybody was worried about getting drafted.
Were you?
No. The war had ended by 1972. And then also what happens, Nixon is thrown out of office. He resigns. All that,
all that happened.
All that was happening. Yeah. But we were all, you know what it is for seventh graders talking about the Vietnam War and thinking, wow, we might get drafted in a few years. Because you're seeing it on TV. I remember we used to watch the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite religiously. And in fact, I'm reading a biography on him right now. What an incredible life he had. But every evening would close with him giving the body count. How many people were killed in Vietnam today and how many Vietnamese were killed? And that's the way they judged the war, by the body count, because there was no way they could judge it by any other way. They're like, oh, we conquered this hill. So what? Big shit, But we killed 105 guys, and we only lost 23. Okay, so we're winning, But that war, I see my students on the college level now in the New School and at the Manhattan School of Music. They're so totally ignorant of what's really going down politically and socially that I feel sorry for them. And I get angry with them sometimes too. I says, listen, man, you have to, because what was the last book you read? Mm-hmm. And they're looking at me like, I think I come from a generation that at least I did. I read because I was inspired by my father. I used to see my father constantly reading, always reading. So I wanted to read too. So by the first grade, I was already reading. I was very advanced. Now, I wasn't reading Tolstoy or anything like that, but I could read the newspaper little by little, slowly. And I got better at it. And we were informed. We were more informed. And you had to be, because to just survive on the street. Radio Bamba. Everybody knew each other in the building, even though we were in these little cubicles in the projects. And my father's brothers and sisters, a lot of them lived in the Melrose houses, but in different buildings. We lived in 681. I had an aunt that lived in 305, Titiiri, I remember. Beautiful woman. I mean, my father's sister. Some of my other father's brothers and sisters lived in different other projects. But my mother comes from a family of 15 and my father, I'm sorry, family of 13. My father comes from a family of 15. So my mother's from Jabucoa, my father, Juanita, and my father's from Guanica, Jose. So I got a lot of family.
And were they all now there?
Well, my mother has with my mother, there's 8 of them that are still alive.
And they're in Puerto Rico?
They're in Yabucoa.
And they passed
en la montaña.
The hurricane over there?
Yeah, but we don't know what's happening. We only heard from Ramonita, my mother's youngest sister. Ellos están en el campo, en un barrio que se llama Jacara. The barrios there in Yabucoa are interesting because they're named Jacara, Aguacate, Limone. You know, those are
very simple stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What is Hakana? I don't know. But quizá it comes from Hikara, maybe. I don't know. Actually, that's a good question. Let me ask my mother.
Didn't happen to the water thing? You take water?
Maybe.
Like a little.
The ladle?
The ladle thing? Isn't it
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. I don't think so. But